Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 134, and David is trying to give Henry a face-off to make him crack up on the screen.
It worked.
Henry, yes. You are joining us for this podcast intro. Where are you located?
I'm located in Bristol in the United Kingdom.
The United Kingdom. And you are a writer for us.
Yes.
And I should note that if anyone has ever read any of the podcast descriptions that we have, the reason they sound and look so good is because they're not from me. They're from Henry.
Aww. You can't see my blushes.
Yeah, Henry is a fantastic writer, and he's done a great job. And what he also does, there's a lot of people who are working behind the scenes on the podcast as he actually QCs everything and makes sure everything sounds good and then writes a beautiful, beautiful intro for it, which I usually put them up on all the sites. So they're really great. I'm glad to have you here. And you've also done a lot of other writing, haven't you?
Yeah. So I do customer stories for Chaos Group. Mm-hmm. And marketing stuff.
Right.
Converting stuff from Bulgarian to English.
Really? How is your Bulgarian?
It's getting there.
Yeah.
I think I know the word for cheers, but I don't actually. I've forgotten it.
Yeah. Okay. But you've done a lot of stuff. So if you actually go to chaosgroup.com and check out our website, a lot of those customer stories that are in our magazine section, a lot of them have been written by Henry. In fact, probably almost all of them, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful. All right. So we have a really good guest on this episode, and it's Josh Scheer, who I have known for a very long time, who is currently he's a writer now. That's his position over at Naughty Dog. And one of the big titles that he pretty much that he wrote, I'm sorry, he was a lead writer on it, is Uncharted 4. It's a pretty big title, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Have you ever played Uncharted?
I bought a PlayStation 4 or 3 mm-hmm. just to play Uncharted, but my girlfriend hated it. So
really?
I had to take it back to the shop.
Really?
Yeah.
Was it just freaking her out?
Well, she said it was too noisy.
Oh. Noisy. Yeah. No, I think it's amazing that these games have become so cinematic and so emblematic, and it's really, really kind of awesome to see that. Josh is an incredible person. We talk about the culture of video games a lot. And they're really, really great. And so sort of what the effects they have on the world and what they're doing. So really, really happy to have Josh on, because I needed that perspective about video games to be out there. You know, it's interesting. One of the other pieces of news that came out recently that I saw on The Verge is some research that's being done that uses video games. They're trying to give it as a prescription for people that have mental issues that can use video games to be able to help them with some of their mental exercises in some way.
Sure. Cool.
Really fascinating. Really fascinating stuff. We should tell people, where are we actually recording this intro, Henry?
We're at SIGGRAPH in Los Angeles at the moment.
Yeah. And so it's kind of fun. How's your SIGGRAPH been?
It's been awesome. It's been really, really cool.
Yeah.
I think the hangover's just about worn off now, so...
Well, good. Now
it's
means
time
just,
for another beer.
It's absolutely. It's about happy hour. So there's a... We've had some amazing talks here, right? And you've actually gone in and done a lot of interviews with some of those speakers, right?
Yep.
So you'll be able to get some of those stories if you go to chaosgroup.com on some of the incredible talks. And we've mentioned them before in the podcast, so I'm not going to rehash all of them. But what were some of your favorite talks?
Definitely ASC, Aaron Sims, who's been on the podcast.
Yeah.
Those guys were just amazing, talking about Stranger Things and
yeah.
The Mist and tight turnarounds for TV schedules and stuff like that. So
right.
Absolutely mind-blowing, yeah. And really, really nice guys as well. So.
Yeah, they're super, super cool. I'm always very impressed with them and sort of their attitude. So it was really cool to see what they're doing. Meet Mike went up pretty well, too. I was actually I just literally walked in here from a panel called Facing Mike, where we talked about Meet Mike and where that's going. And just before that, we had our annual Digital Human League meeting, where we're sort of discussing where we want to go. So look for some announcements about that. But WikiHuman data is coming out very soon, so I'm very excited about that. All right, Henry.
Cool.
Hopefully everyone will enjoy this great podcast with Josh Scheer. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
So, all right. So we were talking about video games.
Because
we always do talk about video games, or I always try to poke your brain about it. So the game that you recommended I play, because we were kind of playing, this is a while ago, Karen and I were talking to you about it, and weird games that are not necessarily violent games. She liked Neverworld. Was it Neverworld?
The Neverhood.
Neverhood.
I think you're thinking of. You're talking about the one that's all claymation. Claymation, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's an old one. Yeah,
yeah, she loved that game. She loved it so much she bought the soundtrack to it.
Mm. Yeah, well, you know what? The people who made The Neverhood, they always do some really interesting stuff with the music, too. They actually had a PlayStation 1 game called Skull Monkeys, which was the same thing. It was claymation animated sort of platform. Friggin' impossible, by the way. Really difficult, but it had some absolutely amazing sort of jazzy music that was part of the soundtrack. That was the most enjoyable part.
Well, it was just like, it was just guitar and them going doop 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 boop. And it was just, that was it. And it was just kind of makes you feel good when you're playing the game.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was a lot of fun. But you recommended Psychonauts.
Ah, Psychonauts, yes.
Love that game.
Yeah, so you know what? They're actually working on a sequel as we speak.
I've heard. And it's going to be, is it VR only or is it going to be?
Oh, okay. No, actually, so there is actually a VR Psychonauts game. It's called Psychonauts and the Rhombus of Ruin, and that's out right now.
Right.
You can definitely get it for PSVR, and I'm pretty sure it's out for Oculus as well.
Okay.
And that one's just like sort of a little mini thing. Like it takes, I think, a couple hours to play through. It's not like a huge commitment, but I haven't had a chance to try it out myself, but I understand it's fun. But they're actually working on a proper sequel. And Double Fine and Tim Schafer, the creative director over there, they did a crowdfunding thing for it through Fig.
Right.
And they made their money for it in like a matter of days. So it's definitely got a huge demand for it.
I thought that they even made Psychonauts free at one point, right?
It's possible. There's times when, like, if you have, like, a PlayStation Plus on the PlayStation, like, certain games will be free on the month, and Psychonauts may have been one of those. And you can usually get it for pretty cheap on Steam. It goes on sale often. So,
right.
Yeah, it's definitely something that's fun to
check out.
Yeah,
I love that game. Well, that's the thing that's interesting to me. So I think that's what I want to talk about. We actually don't talk about video games that much on the podcast, so this is...
That's a crying shame.
But it is a crying shame.
That's why I'm here.
And you've had... you've been involved in video games, I guess, to like forever.
I guess if 16 and a half years counts as forever, sure. I mean, if you want to get technical, I've been playing video games since I was six.
Right.
Like, you know, that's when Space Invaders first came out.
Yep.
And, you know, I played that and then it was pretty much all over.
Right.
And, you know, it's always been one of my foremost hobbies over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that... You know, it was never when video games were first around, like back in like the Apple II days and things like that. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to make an arcade game, you practically had to be an engineer. And in terms of like coding the stuff, everything was all done in like a low level machine language and assembly, you know, way the heck over my head at that age.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the Apple II days, I mean, obviously you had AppleSoft Basic and, you know, some Pascal and some relatively simple programming language, but to really actually get the power out of these machines, same thing. You had to learn assembly.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, there were very few resources available to people who like wanted to do this. You really just had to be a self-starter and figure it out.
Right.
And, you know, I was able to glean some of it through people at like users groups and things like that. But, you know, I'd look at these manuals and I'd see things about like, you know, putting things into and out of memory and like making like calls and all these things. And that was always a little bit over my head. So the games I used to make myself tended to be simple or like the old Infocom text adventures where, you know, you'd type something like, you know, get rock and throw it at troll or whatever. So, you know,
right.
That was sort of like my early dabbling. But then you would have people like, you know, Jordan Mechner, who was, a very big self-starter, and he went ahead and made these two games called Karateka and Prince of Persia. Like both of which I would argue were sort of the first stabs at making a video game have sort of a movie-like or cinematic feel. And he did that partially through rotoscoping the animation for the games. It was, it was the most fluid animation I'd ever seen in a game at that time.
Yeah, this especially was, Prince of Persia was just amazing to see that back then.
Yeah, no, this was this was 1988 when Prince of Persia came out, and this was, you know, animation was kind of an afterthought in games oftentimes because, you know, every single frame of animation takes up RAM. And back then, you know, if you're running an Apple II, at best, your machine has 128K of RAM, not even close to a megabyte.
Right.
And so every little bit counts. So, you know, he had to make sacrifices in other areas, but, you know, the end result spoke for itself. And of course, because everything's like a two-dimensional game, you can have your animation frames facing left, and then you can just use code to mirror them to face the other side.
Right.
So you save some that way. But even still, like, that stuff is like incredibly sophisticated at its time. But yeah, you know, it's just always sort of stayed a hobby. But, you know, and I was always, you know, because I was born in 1970, I therefore saw Star Wars when I was six. And therefore, you know, it changed my life forever because it inspired imagination and everything. But then, so that also got me interested in special effects. So like I was, as a kid, I was kind of like, I want to do special effects. I want to do video games. I want to do animation. Strangely enough, I somehow managed to end up doing all three. So I'm very fortunate in that regard. But as far as like, my career went, like I went to college. I got a English degree, because I sort of drifted away from computer science. And I was never great at math. I'll just put that out there right now. And English major degree, film, critical studies minor, history minor, a whole bunch of other stuff that would seem sort of interesting but not potentially useful at the time. But now I'm like using every single day in my job. So, you know, as luck would have it. But after I graduated from college, USC Film School was starting up this brand new master's program in animation. And the year I graduated college happened to be the year that Jurassic Park came out in theaters. And so all of a sudden, you know, the idea of, you know, CG in movies wasn't like this little thing like, oh, this is kind of potentially interesting. It sort of turned into this, holy shit, this is the way of the future. And USC at the time was one of the few schools that not only was offering an animation curriculum, but also had Silicon Graphics machines with the software. Which, you know, that's, you know, $50,000 proposition a piece right there. And so I applied, and it was a brand new program. They were accepting people like right up until the last minute, and they told me I was accepted like at the beginning of August, and I had to move. I had to move my entire life out to Los Angeles in like 2 weeks.
Where were you coming from?
I lived in Maryland originally.
And
you know, I went to school in Ohio, a small liberal arts school called Oberlin. And so all of a sudden I was like coming out to USC, and I was stayed there for 2 years. And you know, it was a good program. They were sort of trying to make it up as they went along, because it was brand new. But again, you know, I had access to the software and the machines, and so I was able to learn this stuff. And of course, back then,
but you are now approaching the machines very differently, right? Because you never, you know, weren't like a computer science person, so you're looking at it as a creative machine rather than a programming machine, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that was kind of the thing, like, you know, even though, you know, the tools we have now obviously are substantially more sophisticated, back this is still like, you know, here's a way to create 3D computer graphics without actually having to, you know any math or programming. So, yeah, you're able to focus on the aesthetic and artistic side of it. But, I mean, of course, you still had to be technical because you still had to, like, figure out how to, you know, rig your models and, like, you know, get all that stuff going. And it's kind of funny. In a way, it was similar to working around in the Apple II days because, you know, we had this software, but everybody was still trying to figure out how to get the most out of it. And, you know, I remember that way back when I was on this mailing list, you know, back when mailing lists were a thing, called the CG car group, the CG character animation group. And it was a bunch of hobbyists. And then, as it turned out later, a bunch of people who you know, were actually, you know, working professionals, mm-hmm. and but we're all sitting there trying to figure out together, like, hey, what's the best way to build a rig for motion capture? I've never done motion capture before. How do you do that with Softimage 2.0,
right,
or whatnot, or Alias 7.5 before it even turned into Maya.
Right, right, right.
And so it was really this kind of exciting time where everybody's just trying to like figure it out together. And it was just a lot of fun. That was the thing. You know, I may not, you know, I wasn't like a solid programmer, but I loved tinkering with stuff and I loved like figuring things out. Mm-hmm. And it just like was kind of a heady time for that. But anyway, yeah. So after that, I went and I actually worked at, Digital Domain in their brand new new media department.
Okay.
And new media was basically what Hollywood companies were calling games. It was right around the time that Myst came out, uh-huh. and suddenly CD-ROM things seemed to be a big thing because you could like make a game with live-action footage and play it off the disc. And Hollywood really wanted to move into this space, even though they had pretty much no idea what they were doing.
There was a phase at that. What was a game? A Privateer 2? Had some like big name actors in it.
Oh yeah,
like John Hurt was in it, mm-hmm. and like Christopher Walken. These are games that were like,
yeah, there's a whole bunch around there. There was Wing Commander 3 and 4 had like Mark Hamill and Malcolm McDowell and John Rhys-Davies and all these other stars. Yeah, because you know it was suddenly technically possible to do this stuff,
right?
And you know the whole new media thing kind of fizzled out because. You know, Hollywood realized that making games was even more substantially risky than making movies in terms of a return on investment. So they sort of bowed out for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a lot of interesting work was being done. But at that point, I had moved away from Digital Domain. I was hopping around from animation company to animation company. I was at DreamWorks for a little bit and Disney Feature doing some, and then doing freelance for various and sundry projects. And, yeah, I was working on one project back at the end of 2000 that was kind of going south, and I was sort of looking around, and I saw that Naughty Dog was hiring. And this was the company that had made Crash Bandicoot, and they were working on a brand new PlayStation 2 game. And, you know, I really admired the work they did on Crash Bandicoot. You know, mm-hmm. it was a fun game, and it was also technically one of the most impressive games on the system. It's like really beautiful.
Right.
And they designed their characters for a very smart fashion and way that could really be expressive, even though they were, you know, barely 200 polygons a piece.
Right.
And, so, you know, I applied for a job there, which this is true. I don't know. I don't think they really do this in visual effects much, but, in games, particularly earlier, it used to be that not only did you like have to come in for an interview, but oftentimes you would have to take a test.
Yes.
And so
we this do was, that for our programmers.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, at the time, I thought it was a little unusual. I was like, all right, that's fine. I've been animating for a while. I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
So this is before a lot of people like, you know, had copies of Maya at home. So, you know, they said, yeah, just come to the office. We'll give you something to do and we'll sort of see how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I go to visit their office, feeling relatively confident about the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I walk in and I see what they're working on, which is... eventually it would become a game called Jak and Daxter.
Mm-hmm.
And they show me some of it, and the animation on the main characters is by far and away the best I've ever seen in any video game. And all of a sudden, like, holy shit.
Right,
and suddenly I get very nervous. And so they gave me the test, which was basically just like, they gave me an audio file and they gave me a character and they just said, like, you know, see how far you can get with this.
Right.
And so all of a sudden I'm like sitting there and, you know, flop sweating like Albert Brooks in Broadcast News.
Yeah.
And everybody, they'd be coming by every now and then and be like, I need any help? You have any questions? Like, no, I got this. It's cool.
Yeah.
And my inward model is like, oh God, shit.
Right.
but they ended up hiring me.
Uh-huh. How long ago was that?
That was in February 2001. So I've been there for like 16 and a half years.
Okay.
And
how old was the company by then?
I want to say, well, let's see. They started making games. It was founded by these two guys, Jason Rubin and Andy Gavin. Jason Rubin now being the head of content for Oculus.
Mm-hmm.
And they started it, I guess you could say back in 87 or 88.
Okay.
So yeah,
they've been around for a while.
They've been around for a long time. So this was like a good, like, close to 15 years into the run.
Gotcha.
And yeah, but this was, you know, when they were finishing the Crash Bandicoot games, they were a team of like maybe 18 people or so. Mm-hmm. And then when they started staffing up for Jack and Daxter, by the time I was hired, I was employee number 32 or 33 or something like that. And now there are, I think, gosh, like 240 employees, which for, given the scope of the games that we do, is actually still relatively small. I mean, if you look at a company like Ubisoft, they have they have like 3,000 people in Montreal alone, not counting all the studios they have scattered everywhere.
They're kind of a big company.
Yeah, they're large.
But so with 240, you still kind of slip under the radar of being a boutique game company in a sense.
A little bit. I mean,
but your games are so good and so renowned and always like the lead game that comes out with the PS4 or whatever.
We're pretty high profile at this point. Right. I mean, it sort of used to be like, you know, Jack and Daxter, we had sort of tried to position ourselves with that as like the new sort of, you know, Crash Bandicoot for the PlayStation 2. Right. And I mean, you know, that was kind of like one thing that people noticed with the PlayStation 2 era on is like the whole era of like the idea of like, you know, the company mascot sort of was like sort of going away a little bit. So we were, you know,
so you mean the idea of like the like Sonic Hedgehog or that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. Gotcha. I mean, you know, Mario obviously is still very much inextricably tied with Nintendo, but yes. It's still kind of like, that just didn't seem to be what people were after anymore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the Jack and Daxter series did perfectly well and, you know, got decent reviews and everything else like that. But, you know, it wasn't really until we made Uncharted, and more specifically until we made Uncharted 2, that like our star really kind of took off.
Right.
And that was just kind of the trajectory over there.
Now, when I sort of used to play video games a lot when I was a kid. Similar to you, I used to play all the Donkey Kongs and those type of games, right? And then there was some during the late 80s, I got really into the Sierra games, right? Because there was games with a sense of humor, right? Or something interesting about it. And so the idea of narrative became important all of a sudden. And I really kind of liked that idea of the narrative. And then it just kept, then I stopped after a while. I think there was something, it was something that I'd found out much later. You know, obviously I played, like I said, I played Psychonauts, a few other things here and there, but it wasn't until I saw just much more major cinematic events that were happening. I mean, you could use Prince of Persia as a good example of something cinematic, of storytelling, but it was something that was much more epic feeling when you play a video game. I played Elder Scroll, Skyrim,
sure.
And it was like, oh my God, like, the, you know, it's just incredible stuff. And then obviously I started playing Uncharted when I got our PS4, Uncharted 4 actually. Mm. And I was like, what's happened in video games? I mean, it's just, first of all, the stories are richer, the things are richer, because let's go back to that period of when I was playing Privateer 2, and it was the cinematic, you know, John Hurt's there, you know, Christopher Walken. It just felt a little awkward.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Feel awkward anymore.
Well, I think a lot of that, I mean, there's a number of factors. It partially depends on how your game is developed in the first place. Like back in the days of like the Sierra games that you played, I also played a lot of the LucasArts games.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, games like, a lot of which are remastered now, like Day of the Tentacle and Full Throttle and, you know, and Grim Fandango, like a lot of those were sort of designed as story games from the ground up.
Sure.
Right. The thing with games like Wing Commander and Privateer and all that kind of stuff, marrying story and games can be incredibly difficult, and it's important to consider how you're going to do it from the start. And a lot of what happened in video game development in the early days was they would come up with a game, they would make the game fun, and then we'd be like, all right, so how do we attach a story to this?
Right? So the story was an afterthought.
It was an afterthought, and, you know, you could kind of tell oftentimes. Or they do the exact opposite which is that they would come up with a story and then they would try to make the game fit it.
Right.
And that doesn't always work either because, you know, when you're developing a story, I mean, obviously it's kind of a iterative process. You know, you're doing revisions and drafts just like anything else. But at a certain point, you sort of declare it done.
Mm-hmm.
If you're creating like, you know, a novel or a play or something or, sure. or a screenplay or whatever, right? But the thing is, games are a very iterative development process. And mm-hmm. a lot of it has to do with like, you know, what is actually fun? What is good gameplay? What is compelling? What is going to pull the player through these worlds that you're creating in order to, you know, see what's around the corner?
Yeah.
And what's really important is that you consider story and gameplay together and you alter them to help the other out.
So, okay. So, and again, I'm going to say, because I haven't played a lot of video games, so those who play a lot of video games are going to, of course, Chris, that's just the way it's done now. But let me just put it this way. Like, I was noticed when I was playing Uncharted 4 that it was a deep, deep-rooted origin story that was happening at the beginning of it, mm-hmm. right? That origin story was also a tutorial on how to use the game.
Yep.
right?
Yep.
And so you got to be invested in the character and do little things just to move through the origin story, which was becoming very compelling, but you're also learning how to crouch, you're learning how to jump yep. on things, you're learning how to hide.
Yep. yeah, well, I mean, part of it is we do try to work the tutorials in now. I mean, you may remember way back in the day, like, you know, you'd get your game and you'd pull out the instruction manual and you'd read it. And this yes. would be like your anticipatory thing. Like, yeah, there's no instruction manuals anymore.
No, and there shouldn't be.
Yeah. And it's really, you know, the game, pretty much every game now just teaches you how to play. And that's just part of, But a lot of our considerations are, well, I guess, here's how we develop stories at Naughty Dog, which is end games.
Well, first of all, let's explain what do you do at Naughty Dog now.
Okay, sorry.
After 16 years, are you still animating?
So, right. So, sorry. I started on the first Jack and Daxter. I was an animator. I worked specifically on the cutscenes, the uh-huh. little interstitial animations.
Yeah.
Then, starting with Jack 2, they made me the cutscene animation lead.
Mm-hmm.
And then, once we were developing the first Uncharted, I was part of the story development team on that. Did a little bit of writing. But once the cinematic stuff started rolling, I sort of moved on to that full time. Mm-hmm. And that was when we were making a big shift there, actually, because Jack and Daxter was all keyframe animation.
Right.
And with Uncharted, we realized that, you know, we were going to be doing, you know, realistic humans. We were going to need to use motion capture,
right?
Which, you know, all the animators like rebelled against, of course. At first, until we actually, you know, tried to animate realistic humans. And they were like, okay, yeah, I guess we could use some help.
Right. right.
But so I was helping develop the mocap pipeline. Just trying to figure out how the heck we were going to do all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so again, that was a lot of fun. And so for the first two Uncharted games, that's what I did. I've like worked on early story development for both of them, did a little bit of writing, and then rolled onto the cinematics once that was going.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had other opportunities to write stuff here and there. And when we were working on Uncharted 3, we were developing this comic book tie-in to go with it. So I worked with the writer on the book to make sure the characters were consistent and like helped him with it and wrote some of the dialogue and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then with Uncharted 4, I was just given the opportunity to move into writing full time, and right. Which was kind of crazy. You know, it's not often you get to make a career change while still working at the same company.
Right.
And it's something I'd always been interested in doing. And I was kind of terrified at the prospect because yeah. at the time the Uncharted series had become very high profile and it's, you know, quite a thing to sort of like jump in with both feet. But, you know, creative director Neil Druckmann, you know, he and I worked together for many years and, you know, I trusted him and he trusted me and we already had like kind of a good rapport going back and forth with writing and feedback. So yeah, we gave it a shot and it turned out okay. So yeah, now I'm full-time writing. I've been full-time writer for like 3.5 years now.
Yeah. And you wrote Last of Us as well, right?
No, that was all Neil.
Oh, Neil. Okay.
Yeah. Neil Druckmann did all the writing on Last of Us. I was working on Uncharted 4 already
but
like early development, like tech and animation. We were researching facial capture for Uncharted 4 because
right.
we hadn't used it for the first three games.
Yeah.
excuse me. But yeah, now, and just, we literally are putting the very finishing touches on Uncharted The Lost Legacy, which is our sort of it's a full game that we're making. It's kind of a spin-off of the series. We're taking two of the secondary characters from earlier in the series and making them the stars of the game.
Interesting.
Yeah, so we just wrapped that up very recently.
Right.
So I've been a full-time writer at this point.
Wow. Well, that's got to be... Okay, so I guess your English degree did help you.
Yeah, finally.
Yeah.
You know, 25 years after the fact.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. I mean, I think it's an amazing thing to be able to look at what game development and game story is. I mean, obviously you've had a passion for games for a long time. You understand, you've followed its development. You also see it as an important art form. I think that's something that I don't think games always get the respect that they need to from some people. Let's just put it that way.
They don't. That's changing a bit. And it's partially because they're just more, it's just much more of a mainstream thing now.
Right.
You know, I mean, back in my ute,
yeah.
You know, to play games, you had to go to a video arcade, you know, they sort of smelled a beer and cigarettes and, right. You know, or, you know, it was, you know, if you're working on your computer at home, you know, you might as well have a Radio Shack radio kit and you're a nerd or something like that. Yep. You know, I mean, you had people who would play them and sort of appreciate them. But it just wasn't quite as mainstream a thing as it, but now, you know, like every kid under the age of 11 knows what Minecraft is.
Yes.
And Mario and absolutely everything. It's just much more immersive. And a lot of that is to do with the fact that, like, you know, those of us who grew up playing video games have kids and are introducing our kids to this hobby.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you also just have the ubiquity of smartphones that are filled with games. So, I mean,
sure.
You know, even people, you know, people who say that they don't play games, they're probably playing Candy Crush somewhere or something on their phones.
Right.
And, you know, when they say they don't play games, what they mean is they don't play Call of Duty or they don't play whatever. But no,
right.
you're probably playing something, very likely.
Right.
Or you've got a exercise app that's kind of gamified because it throws like badges and stuff like that at you whenever you
sure.
meet certain goals. You know, it's sort of like whether you realize it or not, you're probably playing a game.
Well, I think there's a lot of culture that happens with game stuff, right? So mm-hmm. there's people take it for granted, like even just the mobile apps, just the way that whole technology has happened. It's just kind of interesting because obviously when mobile games started coming out, they were either free or you paid for them.
Yep.
But the free ones are just not necessarily always very good or very simple. They're just like, hey, check it out, whatever. I just made mm-hmm. a game and put it mm-hmm. up there on the store. Now everything's free to play. All this incentivizing, it's just kind of like the game market has gotten very strange in the mobile world.
Yeah, and it's actually one thing that games have that... I don't think I would call it a stigma, but it's a thing that it's never really been an issue with, like, say, books or movies or things like that.
Right.
A lot of people equate the value for money with games with their inherent playtime, like how many hours of enjoyment.
That's so strange.
Will I be able to get out of this? And it's a question that we are very often asked when we're on press tours, which is that, hey, we're making our new game, blah, 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 blah. And they'll just ask, how long is it? Like,
that's it.
And I mean, they'll ask a lot of other things too, but like, and you know, and I totally understand the consideration because say if you are
but that's even comes on Steam, right? If you're playing yeah. Steam, it tells you how long you've been playing that game.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, it's also, you know, it's sort of a value for money proposition. Like, you know, what am I going to get for my $60 game? Am I going to get something that I am going to play for 5 hours and you don't, and it's not the kind of game that you play more than once.
Right.
Or am I going to have something that, like Minecraft, which is going to last me potentially forever, right?
Right.
And, you know, and if you're somebody who's 16 years old and has saved a lot of money up and you only can afford to, like, buy one game a year or two games a year, then it's a very important consideration.
Right.
But, you know, sometimes it's frustrating as a game developer because you're just kind of like, all right, well, let's see. Chris Marker's film La Jetée is 16 minutes long and, you know, Transformers 2 is 2.5 hours long. And if you paid $5 ticket to see either one of those,
right.
would you say that Transformers is more value for the money because it's like considerably longer or
right.
that La Jetée is a much better film?
Right.
So it's kind of like, yeah, it's a weird thing. So, but it's important consideration.
But you see La Jetée is a better film, but not everyone has seen it, right? That what they've seen is 12 Monkeys, which is a remake of La
right.
Jetée.
Which right? is also shorter than Transformers.
Which is also shorter than Transformers. But the point being that they kind of have to be fed the different kind of thing,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So when I was in my, okay, I'm going to start playing games again, right? And I opened a Steam account and I started playing games and I played Skyrim, as I said. I paid 400 hours of Skyrim, right? Because yeah. it's just an open sandbox. I can do yeah. almost whatever I want. And right. it's just hilarious. And what was even more fun to me was talking to other guys who I would, who are know were playing at DD, were playing it, and I would I'd go to them, and they and each one of us had completely different personas.
Yep.
And they're like, what did you do? You know, like one guy, he went to, the Whiterun and just killed everyone in town, just slaughtered the entire town. I was like, what? That's like the main, that's where you get all your stuff. How are you going to? And he's like, yeah, well, it's kind of changed the dynamics of the game a little bit. So it was just kind of interesting to do that. Then the other game I played, and this was based on my friend Dan Thrawn, who said, oh, you should, the story in this game is amazing, was Bioshock Infinite, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I played that game, and I was, that one's way more on rails. And that one really is, like you said, yep. it's like, it's a timer, right? It's yep. like you go through the whole process. I really loved the game. But what was very interesting to me is I could have actually done without the game part of it. Mm-hmm. I could have done with it as just an entire story. I could mm-hmm. have, I would have paid the $50 to see the story mm-hmm. unravel itself.
Right.
Because it was such a good story in a lot of ways and so unusual and stuff. And so I'm feeling the same thing when I'm playing Uncharted. And it's like, oh, this is really, really cool and like passionate. Like the end of Bioshock Infinite, I've never been at playing a video game where I was almost in tears. You know, mm-hmm. I was like, mm-hmm. I don't know. That's what's changed in video games. I think that they are powerful emotional things that can do powerful emotional outcomes out of them.
Well, the interesting thing is that it's kind of that tricky balance when you're developing something, like how much player control and player choice you provide mm-hmm. within a particular game space. So the example of Skyrim is obviously that's a very open-ended game and it provides a lot of quests and opportunities for you to do, and it allows you to approach them in a very large number of ways, and that allows for a great deal of free player choice.
Right.
I'd argue that the story in Skyrim maybe isn't necessarily as rich.
No,
in some
not.
Ways, because it's really, really effing difficult to make something like that where you have so many different possibilities.
But there's hundreds of stories.
Exactly.
Right.
And really what happens there is what we call emergent narrative, which is a sort of like the stories that happen like as you're playing the game that you go and you tell your friends at the office next day saying like, oh, I walked in and I did this Dark Brotherhood quest, but at the end I couldn't do it or something
right.
like that. That's kind of the interesting about that versus something like our games where we like to call them wide linear, which is to say that, we are telling a story. You are going to play this. You're going to see the story the way we want you to see the story.
Right.
However, within that, we provide a lot of choice for, like, say, how you approach combat setups or how
right.
you approach various and sundry things. But we are still leading you and wanting everybody who plays the game to sort of have the same experience as everybody else.
Right.
And the advantage to that, you know, again, Skyrim, huge world, wide open choices, sometimes a little bit glitchy.
Right.
sometimes some areas are less polished than others,
sure.
sometimes, et cetera, et cetera. And that's just the nature of when you make something that big, you can't possibly make
right.
everything
perfect.
But
it takes forever to make a game like
yeah.
that.
And versus our game, versus Uncharted 4, where because we know exactly where you're going to be at any given time, we can put all kinds of polish and graphical flourishes and everything
right.
exactly where we want, so you can make sure you're going to see it. So
right.
that's kind of the balance between the two that you can choose. And I mean, you know, there's some games that strive sort of like a good middle ground between the two, and some succeed and some don't. But in terms of like getting an emotional response, that's always the hardest thing. Obviously, video games are really good at getting the oh shit, oh shit, oh shit, like visceral
right.
response as you're playing that, because that's what's really good.
Right.
But getting like a sort of like anything resembling like, you know, laughter or sadness or fear and things like that, that's a lot harder. And one thing that we strive to do at Naughty Dog is to have those emotions happen while you're, as we like to say, on the stick, while you're actually playing versus like watching a cutscene.
Got it.
Because in a cutscene, you can revert back to cinematic language. You can have close-ups. You can do all kinds. You can really see people's faces. And, you mm-hmm. know, you can pull a lot of emotion out the same way that you can in cinema. But that's not necessarily what games are most powerful at conveying. If you're able to get those emotions while you're actually playing. That is kind of the key thing.
Yeah, and, that's a challenge.
And I am not about to spoil the ending for The Last of Us for everybody here, but I think one of the best things that we've ever done is a sequence in The Last of Us that an interactive sequence that mirrors a sequence from the very, very beginning of the game. And when it happens and you kind of realize it, the fact that you are controlling the character at that time and, you know, the music is kicking in, the music is kind of a callback to something, the thing that happens at the beginning of the game. And you just realize how far you've come on the journey. That's the kind of stuff that is incredibly hard to pull off and really challenging to do. But when you can do it, it makes it practically transcendent. And I mean, by way of another example, there's a game that came out about 5 or 6 years ago called Journey. And Journey was made by a small independent studio. And the idea in Journey is that you play a traveler. You start in this vast desert, and in the distance, there's a mountain. And at the peak of the mountain, there's a bright light. And your traveler is just wearing this long cloak. Mm-hmm. You can't see its arms. You can't see its face, just a couple of eyes. It's hooded. And all you know is that you have to get to the mountain. And so you start making your way across the desert. And you learn as you're playing that, like, as you find these little things, they'll sort of, like, help you fly short distances. And you can't talk in the game, but you can emit these sort of musical chirps that can be seen. And what's interesting about the game is that it's actually multiplayer, but it's done in a very subtle way. At a certain point, as you're wandering across the desert, you may come across somebody else. And the somebody else is another player from who knows where, somewhere in the country. And and you can choose to hang out with this player and do the journey together or not. You can sort of go on your own. You have no way of communicating with each other except through these little chirps that you can do. So if you want to say, like, come here, maybe you just, like, chirp a couple of times, try to get their attention. There's no way to mess with the other player like you can in other long line games. You can't kill them. You can't, like, impede their progress in any way. And what ends up happening most of the time is that when you run into somebody else, two of you just sort of, like, go off together, because as it turns out, if you're in proximity to them, they can help, the two of you can help each other fly farther or, like, regain your energy faster and things like that. And what ends up happening is you, from going from the desert to the top of this mountain, you go on, as the name of the game implies, this epic journey together. And at the very end, when you reach the top, there is, you've been playing this whole thing together. There hasn't been a single cutscene. There hasn't been a single bit of dialogue exchange, the two of you, but the two of you have bonded with this other person through this shared interactive experience. And the one thing that has never happened to me in playing any other game ever is, like, the first couple times I played the game and beat it, and I played it when it first came out, so everybody was kind of new to it. A few minutes after finishing the game, I actually got a message from the other player, because at the end of the game, it tells you who you played with. That gives them, gives you their username. They actually sent me a message saying, like, hey, that was awesome. Thanks so much for doing that with me. And it's like, holy shit. You know, you can, so, you know, video games are not always about, like, running in and blowing everybody up and calling them names, right? This is, like, this interesting, like, shared positive experience. And that's the kind of stuff that is impossible to do in film. I mean, you know, you can sit there and everybody can enjoy a movie together, but it's not quite
the same. You're basically by yourself in the movie theater.
This is, it's not quite the same thing. And that, to me, I think is what's interesting about games and why I do think they're an important and valuable art form for the 21st century.
So that brings up an interesting thing, because there is obviously a big social part of games now, right? Now games are much more interactive with other people, which can be a good thing and a bad thing. So I remember, actually, when I was in grad school, I was playing Diablo. And I was playing Diablo and was online, obviously, right? And I would go on adventures. And I'd always run into this person that I've never met in my life, whatever. And it was this woman who was playing the game, and she was in San Francisco. And she and I would meet every night around the same time online and go play our adventure together and do the same thing and get, you know, advances our characters or whatever we were doing. So it was very weird in a sense that, like, I'm going to meet Sarah. I've never met Sarah. I don't know who Sarah is, but she and I play every night this game. And that's a social aspect that I think is very interesting. But what do you think the implications of that are? And do you think, why do you think that there are so many, there's a stigma about video games, about violence and bullying in video games. Mm-hmm. And why do you think that happens?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things there. I mean, obviously, playing online games socially has become a huge thing in the last decade or so. And, right. you know, you can all have to do is like look to like MMOs like World of Warcraft.
Right.
MMO being massively multiplayer online for
right.
those not familiar with the jargon, where, you know, you do quests and things like that, but really it's also just an opportunity to like hang out with your friends and like go do stuff together.
Right.
And, you know,
one guys who work here, it's interesting, is his mother, mm-hmm. who's a retired nurse, plays with other retired nurses. She plays World of Warcraft.
That's awesome.
So they all get together and they do the panda version, or I don't know, whatever.
Well, you know, I mean, it's a way to hang out with your friends.
Right.
You know, and, you know, you're not necessarily having to like go out and be somewhere, particularly like if you all like live in different cities.
Right.
And things like that. And it's just like a thing that you can do together that's fun. Mm-hmm. And it's nice in that regard. Now, of course, you know, there's also the, I think some people call it the greater internet fuckwad theory, which is the idea that, you know, like a microphone plus anonymity equals, you know, right. possible jerk.
Right.
And so it's not as much of a problem in games like Warcraft and whatnot, but much more in games like Call of Duty, where, you know, it's very, rather than these cooperative experiences, it's these very competitive experiences, like where you're trying to get the highest score or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there's just like a lot of smack talk.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes the smack talk, you know, smack talk can get vulgar and things like mm-hmm. that, but sometimes it can get vile. Sometimes it right. can get racist, sometimes get offensive. But the problem is, like, you know, people are anonymous and you can't see them, and they're not saying it to your face. They're right. they're safe, and they feel safe, and they can say anything they yeah. want. And the worst thing that will happen to them is likely that they'll just get like booted from a particular game versus right. like, you know, say being banned for life or, you know, punched in the face.
Right, right, right.
So, you know, that's just a thing that unfortunately you have to deal with. And it's even worse if you're a woman. Women who play games have been dealing with that shit forever.
Yeah.
And it's awareness of it has been increased in recent years, and a lot of companies have been striving to do things about it. But there's just always going to be...
What was the big controversy that happened?
Oh, Gamergate. Yes. Yeah, that was... that sort of set the image of our industry back like about two decades or so. Yeah, you know, it's something that everybody's still sort of striving to find ways to do better with. But, you know, the fact is there's always going to be jerks out there. So really what we're trying to do is find ways to filter those jerks out. So,
yeah,
you know,
I mean, it's like, for example, the game you were just describing, Journey, sounds like it's almost impossible to be a jerk.
Yeah, that was by design.
The most jerky thing you can do is just walk away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Which, you know, is a totally, but that's a totally legit choice. If you're right. just like... The fellow Genova Chen, the fellow who was the creative director on it, it was just like he was inspired by the hikes that he would sometimes take, and like mm-hmm. sometimes he would bump into somebody and they'd walk part of the way together and they'd chat and then they'd like split ways, or he'd see somebody and he would just like, he didn't feel like being social and just be like, eh, good morning, and then sort right. of like, you know, move on.
Kept moving.
And that was kind of the sort of the design ineptus behind a lot of the online choices there.
Right.
But, you know, in a lot of types of games, it's unavoidable. Like, you know, Blizzard has their new shooter, Overwatch, which mm-hmm. is very, very popular. And they're starting to apparently have, now that it's starting to become more well-known and popular, it's starting to have a jerk problem. And right. so Blizzard is now trying to find ways for the community to, like, filter and report people who are being abusive or, you know, whatnot. But, you know, it's a constant struggle. I mean, Riot Games, who makes the insanely popular League of Legends, mm-hmm. You know, that... community up until fairly recently apparently was very toxic, mm-hmm. Particularly for new players. It's a game with a very steep learning curve, and you know, if you get started, you sort of have to deal with a torrent of nonsense from your teammates who are maybe not quite so patient, but they've worked with their community over the years. They've gotten a lot better at it, but it's like they have people there whose sole job it is to make sure that like people are, you know, being not assholes
right
online. And it's just a constant struggle, and it's just sort of it's just unfortunately part of it.
But do you think that that, you know, that that just what games are in a lot of ways, they're ways of they're community events at this point, right? So mm-hmm. especially in massive world stuff where, you know, I walk in, what's interesting is like I what did I play a little bit of it was another MMO. I don't even remember the name. Anyway, I was playing, and there's just a, because of the MMO, there's actually a ton of people walking around, mm-hmm. right? There's a lot. That, and I know that this little thing walking around is another person somewhere in the world.
Yep. Right? Yep.
And I'm looking at that person, and I, instead of going, hey, what's going on? They're just completely ignoring me. They're doing their own thing, yep. right? And it's just kind of a weird concept because, well, I guess it's the same as me going to Target. I'm not going to say hello to everyone at Target, right?
Right.
But it is a strange social aspect that goes on in video games. And I'm wondering how different that is from the real world. And obviously a lot of people have been saying it's like, oh, the way that you interact socially with people online is going to be different the way that you act socially with other people. I just, there's a social aspect about the way that people work, and I'm hoping that that's changed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's, like I said,
you don't want to have hall monitors all the time.
No, no. I mean, you know, like I said, it's often, it's usually oftentimes with the more competitive games like Call of Duty where you,
right.
or League of Legends, where you do get this smack talk right. culture that is still very pervasive. But mm-hmm. in some of the larger, like online open world games, I mean, you're always going to have jerks, but most of the time people kind of like want to help each other out or, you know, at worst, like ignore you.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the, I think, really positive aspects of this new sort of social, these new sort of social games is that a lot of people who maybe in real life are introverts or have trouble making friends mm-hmm. or whatnot, this, in the same way that it gives jerks a safe space from which to hurl their insults, it also gives people who are shy or introverted, socially awkward or whatever, to a safe way to, like, you know, get to know other people.
Right.
And, you know, obviously, you know, there are some people would say, well, it'd be much better if they met people in real life. And I'm like, well, I guess, sure. But, you know, these friends that they make while they play online are no less real than the friends that they would make by like hanging out somewhere in real life. You know, they're still talking about stuff. They're still doing things together.
Right.
It's just that they don't happen to be sitting in the same room,
right.
but it still counts. And
so this is, this brought up an interesting conversation because I was having when Pokemon Go came out, right.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure I'd love to hear your opinion about this because I was looking at it as, isn't it awesome? Everyone's getting up and getting out of their house.
Yes. Oh, it's amazing.
And so I was walking around, you know, like downtown Burbank. And it's not as popular now, obviously, by a long shot. But I was sure. walking around downtown Burbank, which had a lot of Pokestops and stuff. And at night, it was just filled with people playing Pokemon Go. Everyone was playing. People were talking to each other that they've just met, just like an online game.
Yeah.
And someone was like, oh, what's wrong with all these people playing a stupid video game? It's like, these are people that would normally just be in their house playing a video game. Now they just happen to be outside.
Yeah, no, it's. I think it was great. And I mean, you know, obviously, one of my favorite videos of that time is like, I think it was like Central Park at night. There was some rare Pokemon, and you just saw like dozens and dozens of people just like flooding in and like right. walking around and like trying to help each other out, find it and things like that. And that, I mean, in addition to just being hilarious, it was also just kind of awesome. Like, you right. know, here is this shared experience that everybody's having. Over this thing that, you know, yeah, sure, technically it's just a video game. It's a little inconsequential, but yeah, it's like you said, they're getting out of their house, they're meeting new people, they're doing stuff. And I think it's amazing.
Yeah. It's funny because I just little side story. When I was, my son Brady was hanging out at my wife's work, as many people know on the podcast, she's a flame artist, and he was just hanging out there for a while. And then he just wanted to walk around. So he went out in the hallway and he ran into someone. And the person looking at him is like, what are you doing? Are you, what you doing? Or are you hunting for Pokemon or something? And then he says, no, I'm not. But did you heard what happened in Central Park? Said my son to this person. They started talking for like 50 minutes, started talking. My wife's like, who is he talking to? Went outside to look at him. And apparently it was Christopher Guest. So,
oh, funny.
So, and Brady had no idea who he was, but he just wanted to just talk about Pokemon for a while.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, but I think it is a good thing. And in a thing that the social aspects of games that are evolving. And I think that the games are still very misunderstood. And I think that there's a lot of connotations of violence in video games, bullying in video games, stuff like that, that the more that people Wasn't there even a conversation that happened with who's the big movie critic? Was it Siskel or Ebert?
Roger Ebert.
Roger Ebert.
Yeah, he said games could never be art.
Right.
That was very specifically.
But I think he may have actually changed that position at some point.
He didn't change the position so much as say that he may have overstated it, but his own definition of art sort of excluded the idea of interactivity. Insofar as...
That's a weird...
Which is kind of an unusual thing.
There's a lot of interactive art beyond games.
But I mean, to him, I think art was more about the author than the person looking at the art or engaging with the art.
Okay.
So that as soon as you introduced somebody else into the equation, it no longer like had the same artistic vision or integrity that the original piece did.
Okay. So would you say that his experience is that art is experienced as a third person and then games are first person experiences?
I suppose. I mean, I kind of wish at a certain point he just was kind of like, and let me just be clear, I have huge admiration for Roger Ebert as a film critic and also as a writer. I love a lot of the stuff that he was doing in his blog in the final years of his life. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point he was just like, you know what? I'm tired of talking about this. We're going to have to agree to disagree. And he sort of like left it at that.
Because, well, it's a big matzo ball to leave out there.
You know? Exactly. But, you know, it's because, you know, a lot of people were coming onto his blog. It was like, how dare you say that games can never be art, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I mean, I think it was an interesting conversation. And, I mean, part of me is kind of like, who cares that much?
Sure.
But it's also, to me, like, I mean, yeah, they're art. They have a creative vision. You engage with them in the same way. They can make statements. They can make you feel a certain way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I suppose you could also argue that because games are this big collaborative venture, they're not regarded in quite the same way as film is, because film oftentimes is sort of associated with a director and like the director's vision and things like that. I mean, films are super collaborative, obviously, but like, you know, people will say like, oh, it's a Truffaut film or it's a Spielberg film or it's a whatever, blah, 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 blah. And you get a little bit of that in video games. There are certain people like our own Neil Druckmann now, Hideo Kojima, who does the Metal Gear series. Mm-hmm. There are a number of video game makers that have a very distinct stamp on the stuff that they make.
Sure.
But that's not as common or as easy to do as a lot of other things.
And people
things
aren't necessarily seeking them out.
Right. And it's also, yeah, you don't necessarily, you're like, oh, did you hear about the new... don't necessarily
But isn't
say,
that kind of, I'm sorry, but okay. Isn't that kind of awesome? Because don't you think that like it's a little bit of a, they have to put a big star in some movie just to make it appealing?
Well, exactly. And that's actually one of the things, like nobody buys video games because of the voice actors who are the actors who are in it. They buy it because, you know, it's either a studio with a good reputation or it just looks interesting to them. It looks like it appeals to them. And, you know, going back to the question about, like, you know, the violence and the stigma and things like that, that's obviously there's always the there's moral panic about new stuff every, you know, couple of decades ago, you know,
it's sure.
You know, capital T that rhymes with P that stands for pool kind of thing from mm-hmm. the Music Man. It's like it's pool, it's like horror comics, it's mm-hmm. It's whatever, and now it's video games. These are the things that like the older people don't necessarily understand, and they see the kids playing it and they're just like, oh my god, what is it doing to their minds? And quite a lot of studies have shown that generally what it is doing to their minds is nothing, or at least no more significant than watching violent movies or reading violent books.
Right.
And, you know, people say, but what about the interactivity? It's you actually doing the thing. But again, the same thing, the studies have shown it's not necessarily, you know, contributing to more violence in society.
Right.
There is the issue of like kids or adults playing games for maybe a little bit too long, and that's a completely separate issue.
Well, there is an addiction problem with games.
Yeah,
definitely. In some cases, I mean, I know there was a Wall Street Journal article that came out just a day or two ago about a problem with people not getting jobs because they'd rather just stay home and play video games.
That is, I think, I haven't read the whole article. I've read some things about it. It mm-hmm. sounds kind of horseshitty in some ways. But here's the interesting thing. The article is talking about a large part of millennials, and that's frank. The job market's terrible,
right?
And it's hard for people to get jobs. And one thing that games provide mm-hmm. is, in a weird sort of definition of the term, a job. You know, people, you go to work, you perform certain tasks. Yeah,
I see what you're saying.
You know, you get paid. Obviously, that's the big advantage of a job versus a video game. But, you know, it provides structure to your day. Whereas, mm-hmm. you know, you play a video game and you do certain tasks.
Achievements.
There are things that are sort of, you feel like you're getting something done, right. even though, you know, it doesn't necessarily have any tangible benefit to you in the real world, you right. know. And I can definitely see people who are, you know, struggling to get work and are getting frustrated. You know, here is a comfort zone where, you know, you have something a little bit predictable to right. close out your day. So
what do you think the impact, because I think there are a lot of benefits to games. I'll give you an example. When I see my son playing a video game and he's playing, you know, Lego World or whatever he's doing, I see a lot of creativity coming out of him, mm-hmm. right? I see a lot of fun things. He's like, he built this giant mountain and it started rolling down in different vehicles and he was cracking himself up. And he's playing, you know, in his own way, mm-hmm. much more than watching the same episode of, you know, Teen Titans Go 17,000 times in a row.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
So I do see a benefit to that. And I see, like, you know, at least he's coming up with some ideas rather than just saying, I'm going to watch this over and over and over and over and over again. So what do you think the impact of games is going to have on people outside of games? Like, what has games done, did you think, that or will do, or would you like to see be done, that has an impact beyond actually playing a video game?
Well, what I would hope is that games like Lego Worlds and Minecraft and all those sort of things, like they encourage people to be creative. They encourage people to, if you're playing with anybody else, they also encourage people to be collaborative and mm-hmm. in a positive sense. And hopefully those kinds of skills will sort of like translate to the people who play them, you know, in the real world, because they see that, you know, they can only get so far by themselves. But if they work with other people, they can strive to do better. And likewise, you know, a lot of these games offer opportunities for like problem solving and things like that. There are these games that are sort of set up systemically such that, like, you know, that like, oh, well, if I do A, then B will happen. And if I do C, then D will happen. But how mm-hmm. can I use these in combination to, like, you know, get past this obstacle that I'm doing? Mm-hmm. And a lot of these games allow for creative thinking, for problem solving, you know. And that's the thing. Not every game is like a run-in, guns blazing, and shoot everything kind of game. A lot of them offer opportunities to go in and try to figure this stuff out. And, you know, that I think is like the most interesting aspect of games, and where, you know, we're starting to see, there's a number of, I know, classrooms that actually use modified versions of Minecraft to get the students to do things and collaborate together in a way, you know, saves them money on Lego sets and also you know, fosters creativity. I think, mm-hmm. I think that stuff's fantastic. I mean, obviously, you know, we don't want to also turn into a nation of shut-ins and end up like all the people in the floating chairs in WALL-E. But, you know, there's
right.
push and a pull.
One of the things, as an example, that's why I really thought, I was like, well, great. AR is going to, you know, change that in some way where we're actually going to have to go outside and do yep. something, you know? So I see a little bit of that. I don't necessarily, I guess there's a balance, right? I think of where people can do, but I think there's a massive benefits to gaming in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, whether it's used in a sort of a way to incentivize your achieving your own goals, like, I mean, you know, there's, you know, exercise apps are
right.
are gamified. You know, I have there's a meditation app that's slightly gamified.
Really?
And like, I mean, it's not so much competitive, but it's just a way to measure your progress right. throughout the thing. And it's not necessarily like, it doesn't necessarily like say throw obstacles in your path per se, but you know, there's an app that's a to-do list. and you make the list. And as you cross things off, you get like new, you get new stuff. It's kind of like set up like a role playing game.
Wow.
For that, you know, and that, and if, hey, if that helps you get shit done, great. Anything will help in that regard. But I also, you know, I think seeing some more interesting social aspects of the games, and that's just going to keep on expanding and expanding. And you're always going to have your competitive games. You're always going to have your Call of Duties, your League of Legends, and all these sort of things. I mean, they're even started doing like, and StarCraft, they're even doing like esports stuff now in America.
Yeah,
and all that stuff is really cool and interesting to watch.
Another thing I want to bring up is all the stuff like. Was it called Stitch or what the, it's like people watching other people play games. Twitch. Thank you. Twitch. Like that is huge. Twitch is bigger than Netflix.
Yeah. No, Twitch and YouTube. There are a number of streamers, as they're called. There are people who will play games and they'll have a camera pointed at themselves and they will be recording themselves playing the game and watching it. Mm-hmm. And people will just tune in and watch people play these games and react to them. And at first, when this first started happening, I was kind of like, that's interesting. I don't know if I'd want to be spending my time doing that. But there is an appeal to it. And a lot of it just sort of has to do, particularly, the character, the persona they put off, many of whom I find viscerally annoying. But the interesting thing, though, is particularly in games that I've already played, it always fascinates me to see how other people respond to things.
Huh.
And, you know, there's this horror series that was out on the PlayStation 2 a while back called Fatal Frame. Mm-hmm. And it was a ghost game. It's from Japan. And the second game in that series is still by far and away one of the hands down the scariest games I've ever played in my life, like scarier than most movies. And there is this wonderful series of videos of just a bunch of dudes, like you couldn't see them. They just recorded their voices, just responding to the stuff in the game. And it was hysterical. It was kind of like how, you know, if you go to see a horror movie and then you take your friend to see it the next day and you get to see your friend like jump in their seats and everything else. Like that. It was like that, just over the course of a game.
Right.
And it was just hilarious. It was a lot of fun to watch. And, you know, I think, and likewise, more recently, you know, I've played through The Last Guardian, and, you know, I'm not going to get into spoiling any of that there. But after I finished it, I went back and I actually watched some of these YouTube streamers who are tend to be very like cavalier and devil may care about that stuff. It's like, all right, let's see how you do with the last 3 hours of this game. Right. And it was just fascinating to watch to see their own responses to something else that I had. But it's also, you know, particularly like with Twitch and YouTube, like, you know, people can like type in comments like as the people are playing, and as the people are playing, they'll see these comments scroll by on their screen so they can respond to them and say, oh, hey, Pokemon 27. You're absolutely right about that thing.
Right.
And so it does kind of become this little participatory social thing.
Right.
Even though you're not sitting there with the person or directly communicating with them, you're still sort of experiencing this game at the same time that they are. And of course, because games are, you know, they're not cheap, and a lot of people can't afford to buy more than one or two games a year. Mm-hmm. Like maybe somebody can't afford to play The Last of Us, but they can watch PewDiePie play through the entire thing over 17 episodes.
Right.
And even though they didn't get to play it, they got to kind of experience it with them.
Right.
And that to a lot of people is, you know, because a lot of these games, going back to the original conversation, because a lot of these games are so story-based now, it feels like you're watching an interactive movie.
Right.
So, you know, it all sort of comes full circle. And I myself, you know, or I should say at Naughty Dog, we do a lot of internal focus tests, like particularly like in the last 4 months of a project, we will start bringing people in from the outside and we will have them play our game.
Right.
And now because the PlayStation 4 has streaming capabilities, we not only record all these statistics as they're playing, but we point a camera at them and then we give them a headset and we encourage them to respond vocally to the stuff that they're seeing in the game so that we have an idea of, you know, if areas are too frustrating or if they're having fun or if they liked something or they didn't like something. And, you know, obviously in the early days of these focus tests, it's sometimes a little disheartening because you're just standing there saying like, just go up the ladder to your right. Why don't you see the ladder? Right. Ah! And then, you know, you go in and you redesign that area to make it a little bit clearer.
Right.
But, and especially because a lot of this focus testing is happening in our final push when everybody's working really hard and maybe starting to get a little burnt out or frustrated or just done.
Right.
But we can go in and we can watch these focus testers playing our game and responding positively to the stuff that we've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
That is so inspirational and so motivating to a lot of people. So how far are you in Uncharted 4?
Not far.
Okay. There is, I won't spoil it, but about five chapters into the game, there is a fairly large self-referential Easter egg that we dropped in there we weren't sure how people were going to respond to it, and we sort of kept it very, very secret. But when people got to that part in the game, they just flipped out. They absolutely loved it.
Uh-huh.
And so as we were approaching the end of the production, like anytime we had a focus test, people would like type around like, oh, they're almost at that part. And everybody would stop what they're doing and they'd tune into the streams and they'd like all the testers like play this thing and see how they respond. And, you know, it was always just like this great inspiration for us.
That's funny.
And then likewise, same afterwards, it's interesting for us to see how people respond to the game that we make. So when the game was released, I would go and I would watch all these people with crazy names, PewDiePie, Jacksepticeye, Markiplier, like play our game for their audiences and just sort of like see how it goes. And the fact is, these people, these streamers, they're now being referred to as influencers, which is a weird name. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, we were worried when this first became a thing that people would be like, oh, I'm just going to watch this stream and then I don't have to play the game. And it's like, no, as it turns out, these things actually help drive sales to some degree because people see other people having fun with this and like, oh, I want to experience this thing myself.
Right.
And they'll go out. And now, you know, a lot of these people are actually getting paid by game companies to play their game or at least play part of their game and respond to it. So it gets out there. And the Swedish guy, PewDiePie, he has, I don't even know how many million subscribers right now.
Right. He got in trouble recently.
He did because he made some very ill-considered anti-Semitic jokes.
Right.
Nice job. I don't think he realized what he was doing, but anyway, it was still asinine at best.
Right.
But the thing is, he made like $4 million last year.
Just streaming stuff.
Like playing games and making goofy noises. I mean, it's a lot more than that. He has his own appeal. He does, and he produces a lot of content. Like he works hard at it. It's not like he just sits there and goes, blue, blue, oh no, I'm getting killed or whatever.
Right.
It is actually a job, but he was making money hand over fist. And a lot of these really popular streamers are making tons of money.
Right. Well, I think it's interesting because it was someone was saying, well, why would you watch someone else play a video game? Isn't the point that you played a video game? And I was saying, it's like, you know, every now and then I play basketball, but then every now and then I watch other people play basketball.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good analogy. And again, you know, the big difference is because on Twitch or YouTube chat, you can type in stuff as they're playing and if they see it and they respond to it, then, you know, that's like, hey, that's cool.
Yeah.
I'm part of it too.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it still does have this participatory aspect to it.
Yeah, I think that game culture is highly misunderstood, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that you know, there's been a lot of people putting down millennials. I'm just going to put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think millennials are highly misunderstood.
Oh, sure.
And they're actually having some pretty good comebacks these days about the situation they're in is because of the situation that the previous generation put them
in. Oh, yeah. No, it's the same story every single time. You know, the baby boomers look down on Gen X.
Right.
And it just sort of keeps on propagating.
But I think that there is something very – I think that game culture is – comes out of millennials in the sense what I'm saying is I also think it is misunderstood.
A lot of it is. I mean, let's be clear, there are a lot of obnoxious bro types in gaming. That's
sure,
where a
but
lot
there are
of,
lots of bro types in the real world.
Exactly. And you know, and Gamergate, as it turned out, who knew what's going to be a harbinger of like all these alt-right people that are apparently now running our country. Awesome. The thing is, gaming overall is incredibly positive and incredibly inclusive community. Like, people enjoy games. People enjoy wanting to play with other people.
Right.
People want to bring people in. It's just that the obnoxious people tend to be the ones that are louder.
Right.
And that's kind of the big challenge of not only the game community, but also game developers, is to amplify the voices of the people who are positive and inclusive and just try to get the other voices to chill out a little bit.
Right.
Because, you know, you don't want to exclude anybody, even if they're being obnoxious, but you want to make sure that they're driving people away.
That's also not going to make much news, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, a bunch of people played a video game, nothing went wrong, everyone was happy. It's not going to be a headline that one of them.
Sure.
So the other story makes a better headline.
Yeah, exactly. But the fact of the matter is, like, you know, I go to the Game Developers Conference when I can, mm-hmm. and whenever I go there, it's always this really invigorating experience, because everybody there is so in love with what they do,
right?
And everybody there is just so positive about the industry as a whole. I mean, you know, we go there and we talk about some of the not so nice aspects, and we talk about ways that we can combat it and just sort of like make it better for everybody. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that's been fantastic in the last 10 years, and really particularly in the last 5, is that not only the people who play games have become more diverse, but the people who are able to make games has also become more diverse. And a lot of that has come down to the fact that, you know, again, back in my Apple II days, like, you know, there was no game engine. You had to basically do everything yourself. Mm-hmm. Now, all these game engines are not only available, but they're either incredibly cheap or they're free. Like,
yeah.
You can get, you know, Unreal is free, and as long as you're just sort of tooling around with it and like making stuff. And then when you want to actually try to sell something with it, that's when it sort of comes in, and it's actually fairly reasonable. Same with Unity.
Right.
There's a software called Game Maker that, again, is very simple, low-level entry. Like, even if you have no programming knowledge, you can kind of get started and make stuff with it. Mm-hmm. There's Twine, which is kind of allows you to make games that are slightly more sophisticated, like choose-your-own-adventure kind of things. Mm-hmm. There's a number of options, and what's happened is it's opened a door to all these people who maybe had a story to tell, or they maybe had like something to say, and now they have a way to say it. And it's not only the game engine availability, but it's also the internet, honestly, because before, like, if you wanted a game out, either, you know, you had to do what you did in the old days, which is like stick it on a floppy disk and put it in Ziplocs and sell it at your store, or you'd have to have a distributor so that you actually get shelf space or whatnot.
Right.
But now you can get thousands and thousands and thousands in games, not only from Steam, but like independently online, and people could just like put their stuff up there. And you're going to, and to me, you know, as much as I love the games that we make at Naughty Dog, and as much as I love some of like the big budget titles, to me, the most interesting stuff being done in games is the stuff that's being done by smaller independent studios,
right?
Because they are more willing and able to take risks in not only like the content and the gameplay, but also just like what they're able to do.
Right.
And so, to my mind, some of the more interesting stuff being done, let me just see if I can think off the top of my head. Okay. So there is one game called Dysphoria, which was done by a woman named Anti-Pixelanti. And she is somebody who, she's transsexual. She's transitioned recently. Mm-hmm. And Dysphoria is a game about what it felt like to do that transition. Mm. And what's interesting is that it's essentially a series of little mini games. Like, there's one that's a little bit like Tetris, one that's a little bit like Pac-Man, one that's a little bit like that. But the way that she designed these little mini games was in a way to sort of, through the interactivity of this game, make you feel what it felt like to undergo certain aspects of that transition process, like certain things like the sort of the frustration of a certain point, or like how easy a certain point felt, or how weird a certain point felt. And again, you know, this was, you know, she did this on her own. It's very simple, but, you know, she was able to make it and put it online and allow people to experience it. And, you know, and this is something that you know, obviously be kind of a hard sell in GameStop.
Right.
And it's fantastic that there's all these voices out there that are now able to tell these games, make these games. So there's that. There's also one of my favorites of recent years is this game that's very much reminiscent of the old LucasArts and Sierra games called Kentucky Route Zero.
Okay.
And it's a story game. It is essentially about a delivery man who's doing one last job before he retires. He has to deliver something to somebody in Kentucky, but the only way to get there is this mysterious underground road called Kentucky Route Zero. Mm-hmm. And he picks up all these people along the way, and it's this journey that takes place. And you're just pointing and clicking. There's no real puzzles to solve, but he meets people and you talk with them. And what's interesting is that the dialogue choices that you have aren't necessarily for like solving puzzles or getting past obstacles, but it's defining who these people are through mm-hmm. your own personal experience. And the whole thing has the feel of the way it's staged. The whole thing has a feel of a theatrical play, and the vibe of the whole game feels very much like if Haruki Murakami or David Lynch wanted to make a video game.
Right.
And again, it's the same thing where like 3 years ago, the makers of the game said, we're making this game called Kentucky Route Zero. It's going to be 5 acts. We're releasing the first act right now. Mm-hmm. It's just the three of us making it. Mm-hmm. If you pay $20 right now, you get the first act and then you get all the subsequent acts as we release them. Mm-hmm. They just released act 4 last year. They're working on act 5. It's just phenomenal.
Wow.
And again, same thing, small independent stuff. And I mean,
but I think that just also, okay, just going back to what you were saying about Unreal, because this has become a subject for us. Mm-hmm. Those game engines now, or the technology that was originally developed for games, such as Unreal, mm-hmm. is now being heavily, heavily looked into as enterprise applications. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. So in fact, Epic has made something called Unreal Enterprise. I forgot what the exact name is, but they're heavily influencing the world of architecture mm-hmm. and automotive design and all kinds of things.
Oh, sure.
And so that's kind of awesome. And I think that game technology is going to bring more to the world of enterprise in a lot of ways. And I'm just curious to see what happens, because it's not just the idea of, game engines make things look really cool and you can interact with them. There's what people do with that interaction is interesting to me as well. Just like someone created a game about her experience that other people can experience, someone could say, I'm going to take this game engine and make something that is going to be useful beyond a game.
Oh, sure. I mean, the fact is, we deal with rendering technology in the same way that visual effects firms and everybody does too. The difference right. being, of course, that at minimum, we need to be running at 30 frames a second.
Sure.
We don't have hours or days to render a single frame. So that's always been the challenge for us from the get-go.
Right.
And, it used to be like, back in the Crash Bandicoot days, the main character, Crash Bandicoot, had fewer than 200 polygons in his entire body.
Right.
And, now we have the Uncharted characters have, tens and tens of thousands of tens and tens of thousands of polygons. I mean, they're just as detailed almost as a film model is.
Right.
But the difference is, of course, is that we have to come up with tricks and techniques to sort of mimic a lot of stuff that's done in film mm-hmm. in order to achieve the same look.
Right.
And, we're obviously not as sophisticated as film. We can't be. But every year we get closer and closer and closer.
Right.
The holding back points for us are still lighting and cloth. And hair. Those are kind of like three big ones that
right.
you can definitely sort of see.
You can put a lot more polygons onto the screen nowadays, and you can put higher res textures because the memory that you have on cards has gotten better and better and better.
Oh, yeah. No, a lot of the stuff is kind of like, we have subsurface scattering techniques that mm-hmm. are, really good, but they're still kind of faked in a lot of ways.
Well, it's like, rasterizing.
Yeah, exactly. And then you have, you can take a look at our hair. Our hair is still done as like these rather than like a simulation or things like that mm-hmm. it's usually done as like these little flat cards that are arranged in such a way to look a little bit natural, but
right.
then doing anything with it can prove to be difficult
right.
So we try very hard. Like our recent game, the main character, she has like long hair that's tied back in a ponytail mm-hmm. but even still, in order to make it look real with the shaders and the sheen and everything, took a lot of work. And then what we do is we have this sort of progressive degradation of it. Like if you get wet or if you're running around a lot, we have these different states that it moves between, where like you see parts of it like matted to her face mm-hmm. Or like slightly sticky sort of works. But it's all still very much very simple compared to what you're able to get away with like
right.
in a feature film. And it just keeps getting better every year. I mean, if you look at you know, PlayStation 3 versus PlayStation 4. Like on PlayStation 3, the real-time rendering like didn't have a particularly great specular response. So like skin, even if you had good subsurface and occlusion techniques, it still looked a little bit plasticky. Mm-hmm. Like metals were like way too shiny generally. Like right. It wasn't a lot of good stuff in that regard. Like the lighting oftentimes was still fairly severe. It was hard to get something that looks soft. And now with the PlayStation 4, there is a lot of post-processing techniques that we're able to do, like per pixel, that we weren't able to do before. So, but considerably better specular response, considerably better. We're able to do, we have a shader for our game that basically fakes rim light around the characters' faces and bodies and hair. To sort of help them pop from the environment.
Right.
And, you know, every single year and every new system like brings these advances along. And what's interesting is that with PC gaming, like, you know, if you're a PC gamer, you tend to like want to replace your graphics card like every couple of years so that you sort of keep up with the latest and greatest. Right. With the consoles, you know, generally a console life cycle would be like, you know, many more years, like 6-7 years.
Yeah, but
it's like
changing
that.
Now. I think people are trying to make it a yearly thing.
They're trying to make it like a 2-3 year thing. Right. But even still within that,
but it's more iterative as opposed to,
But what happens is within that is that companies just start learning the hardware better. Like if you look at the first Uncharted, it wasn't a launch title, but we still were not able to fully take advantage of the hardware because we're still kind of learning it. So you look at it and you look at the character. We didn't have any subsurface scattering yet. So this character's faces looked plastic and oily and like everything looked a very particular way. Mm-hmm. But we were researching that stuff so that by the time we finished Uncharted 1, with Uncharted 2, we were able to say like, okay, now that we've learned all this stuff, now we know how to make it better. And so we were able to utilize much more of the CPUs on that system and much more. And so the game was able to just look better just within the span of a year on the same older hardware.
Right.
And even when we put out The Last of Us, we came up with some new techniques on this aging hardware that people hadn't quite figured out yet. But you take a look at The Last of Us on PlayStation 3 versus Uncharted on the PlayStation 3, and you're just like, how is this the same system?
Right.
And the same thing is probably going to happen with PlayStation 4. I mean, Uncharted 4 was the first game we put out, and you know, it looks really nice, but you know, there's all these little things that like we were able to do for Uncharted: The Lost Legacy that made it look just a little bit nicer.
Right.
And now we're working on The Last of Us Part 2, and that's a ways away. So, you know, by the time that comes out, we're probably going to have, it's probably, you're probably going to look at that versus Uncharted 4 and think like, wow, we've made some leaps and strides on the same hardware that has only 8 gigs of RAM in it. So, so it's, it's, that to me is, one of the fascinating parts about games. Like, you know, we're always, it's always a new challenge, always trying to figure out like, how can we make our stuff look better? And how can we shave like 2 milliseconds off of this process over here so that we can allow those 2 seconds over here to allow for a more stable frame rate?
Right.
And like all these other things that are just like crazy considerations.
Yeah.
So, you take that stuff out and now you're going to start seeing, that in like architectural visualization or like VR in particular. Mm-hmm. You know, although it's interesting. I was talking with a friend of mine who does VR, and the challenge with VR, like when we're making a game, like if our frame rate isn't stable, it's no big deal because we know we're going to like optimize it and everything will be fine by the end. But for my friends who are making VR games, it's like, no, you have to have a stable frame rate from the get-go. Otherwise, you're just going to vomit when you're trying to develop it every single day. So that's kind of an interesting challenge too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It definitely, I've been doing a lot of VR stuff recently. So it is definitely a big problem and a challenge in a lot of ways. Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time because I know you're busy and I've got to get stuff ready for SIGGRAPH.
But
I'm really fascinated by this. I think this is a fantastic conversation. And I just think that what's going on in the game world is going to be something we can all learn from. And specifically, what I am learning now with what's going on with Unreal, because I think that technology is becoming so important to our customers. Mm-hmm. We have a huge amount of architecture customers, and they're all looking at game technology right now. They're all looking at it as a presentation tool. They're looking at it as a way to interact with things. And I think that even the customers or the clients who are buying this are used to games. So to them, like, you gamify their architecture. it'll make sense. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would imagine there's a couple of reasons for this, and you can please correct me if I'm wrong, but part of it is just because, you know, it's, I guess, in some ways a little more instant. You know, you can drop your thing in there and just like stick it in the engine, then you can immediately start looking around it and things like that. But I think part of it too is that, again, because so many people now are more familiar with like the visual language of games, that like if you were to give them an architectural model that they can just like walk around in, they'll just sort of pick it up and be comfortable
with
it right from the get-go.
Absolutely. But I also think it lends itself to it. You know, the thing about games, is they put you in an environment, right? They put you in an environment, and that environment is architectural. And so one of the things that I got fascinated when I was starting to play Bioshock Infinite is like, wow, that is a fascinating piece of architecture that someone designed, you know? And so I think that there is a, this is something I'm going to a conference in September called Trojan Horse Was a Unicorn. And I'm going to be talking about that specifically. That's going to be my talk, is about how the world of architecture needs to people need to pay attention to architecture when it comes to games and when it comes to movies, because everyone seems to be focused on character and story, which is fine, but you're surrounded by environment, and who architects design environments. And so there's a world of influence that they have in that area.
Oh yeah. I mean, architecture and the design of space is incredibly important for video games, particularly for, you know, the stuff that we make. I mean, not only from like the aesthetic standpoint, obviously, like, you know, we're creating ancient sites or like, you know, Italian villas or whatnot that our characters are moving through. But also we have to do it in such a way that the player understands where they are at any given time and understands where they're supposed to go and what they're supposed to be doing at any given time. And a lot of the stuff that we look at is actually very similar to theme park design. The idea of like the idea of flow through spaces and the idea of visual landmarks, or I guess they call them weenies, and just the idea of like, you know, in our games, if there's some place you want to go, it's like, oh, look, there's a tower.
Right.
And we are always trying to design our levels in such a way that like, you know, you'll see the tower, it'll be far away, and then you'll like go through some stuff. And then when you get to a new vantage point, you'll realize you're closer to the tower, and you're reorient the player saying like, okay, now you're closer, here's where you're still supposed to be going.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of games cheat, largely because they make these vast worlds. So like, you know, Grand Theft Auto, like if you need to go somewhere, there's going to be a giant beam of light coming down from the sky and being like, here's where you need to go.
Right.
But we try really hard not to do that because we want to try to, you know, not remind you that you're playing a video game.
Right.
But yeah, it's an incredibly important. So from like the layout of a level, the shapes that we use to communicate, and just the general flow of everything is all incredibly important. And there's actually an interesting article that one of my coworkers, Amelia Schatz, that's S-C-H-A-T-Z. If you Google it, she did an article about like designing environments for video games. And she did a lot of really interesting insight for like the approaches that we take when it comes to like designing a space so that players, it not only conveys certain emotion, but at the same time allows people to be led through it. And the way that we work actually when we are designing levels is we start with what we call block mesh. The designers will basically just in Maya create a level out of cubes and cylinders and cones and just like simple shapes and just make it in such a way so they can get an idea of the space. And then, you know, you sit and you play the game like that. You wander around, you see if it feels right. You see if the distances between things feels correct. And you actually try to develop as much of the gameplay as humanly possible within this block mesh environment.
Interesting.
Because that's a lot faster to iterate. You know, it's just like, well, this wall's in the wrong place. Okay. I'm just going to move my cube over and now the wall's in the right place.
Right.
And you sort of like try to get that sense of like how it feels. And then once it's feeling good, that's when we hand it to our environment artists. And that's when they start doing like all the super high level detail work. Because obviously at that point, you know, you can still move things around, but it becomes a lot harder
or a lot
costlier because, you know, with our lighting model, you know, we have a lot of runtime and real time lights, but we also do a lot of light baking
light
into
baking,
our labels,
of course.
Right? So, you know, anytime you move a tree, it's like, okay, rebake the whole entire thing,
right?
Do that overnight,
yeah.
So you know, the cost is a lot lower in this block mesh form.
Right.
So, a lot of the times, like when we get to game development, there's multiple stages, and there's alpha and beta and then Goldmaster. Goldmaster is when it's done. Mm-hmm. Alpha is basically means you can play the game start to finish, even if like the artwork's not finished, even if it's like buggy as hell, you can still play it the start to finish. And most of the time, like when a game is in alpha, the majority of it will still be block mesh.
Interesting.
But you can still see like how it's going to play out.
Yep.
Like, and you know, and we actually, we start doing focus testing as early as alpha, and we bring in outside testers just to make sure, okay, can people figure out their way through this? Because obviously we know where to go because we designed the level.
Sure.
We've been playing it. But if we go there and people are like going in circles, we're like, okay, shit, what are we doing wrong? And so we try to figure out ways to communicate that flow better in block mesh form.
Interesting.
But then once we get the environment, if people are still having trouble or something, that's when we can start doing things like lighting and be like, okay, here's our little blinking light bulb above this door. That's where you're supposed to go. Or like,
I've seen a game where they use like a color constantly, like a little bit of yellow everywhere. And that's like, you sort of subconsciously follow yellow.
And Uncharted 4, the way that we delineate ledges that you can climb on is generally through something that's slightly lighter than the rest of the environment.
Right.
So that it sort of becomes, and yeah, that's, you know, a lot of shape design is also incredibly important. So you can delineate, here's where you can go, here's where you can't go.
Right.
It's all just this long iterative process. And we just sort of, or it's just even like the way that we arrange the plants, like, you know, here's where you're supposed to go. It's not entirely clear because of the way the trees are shaped. So let's make something that looks kind of like a door with the branches and the plants and everything, like make it look inviting and like make people want to go that way.
Interesting.
So yeah, it's, that's a whole other,
I think it's fascinating. And I think that like, what I'm saying is I feel that the architecture world could learn from that as well. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like there's stuff that's going on in games that you guys discovered how people interact with their spaces based on how you design that space. So it's a fascinating thing.
Yeah, I mean, I would think it would be important for anybody doing architectural visualization that's interactive to like have people come in and make sure that they can find their way through a space.
Yes.
And even if it's something as simple, I mean, obviously you're trying to show off a building. You don't necessarily want to reconfigure the building so people don't get lost while they're playing their interactive version of it.
Right.
But at the same time, like, how are you lighting this? Like if everything's lit totally evenly, maybe you need to have little like waypoints or things to show you, like, you know, and here, let me show you to the lobby or whatever. So
yeah, it's interesting. I think there's a lot to learn. And I think that that's what I'm going to try to do is see, to just study this, you know, and I think that I can study it through what's going on in games. So I'll look up that book.
You're just going to have to, you just have to play a lot more games basically.
Well, I will do that too, because it is fun. All right, Josh, I really appreciate you coming by. This has been a lot of fun. We'll do our Polaroid and we'll have you on our Wall of Fame.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Thanks, man.